You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Did you ever wonder what it would be like to grow up with an extremely famous parent? On today's program, we're going to be talking to Jamie Bernstein, daughter of Leonard Bernstein, about her new memoir, Famous Father Girl. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lano Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Jamie Bernstein. She's author of the book Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. She will be reading and signing books here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 4th of August at 11 in the morning. She'll also be in Taos the day before, Saturday the 3rd of August at 7 in the evening at the Harwood Museum of Art. And on Thursday, the 1st of August at 6 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Welcome, Jamie, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi. So it's a wonderful book. Fascinating. You grew up as a child of what, I don't know, which I sort of would call artistic aristocracy or even royalty in New York City. Your father was the great composer, conductor, and teacher, Leonard Bernstein. And your life was truly privileged. And a lot of people use the word privilege these days, but you really had extraordinary access to everything and everyone, composers, movie stars, an incredible education, servants, a country house. But, you know, for a reader seeing this from the outside, it's different from being a child living in that world. Talk a little bit about what it was actually like. Were you aware of how unusual your life was?
Well, you know, it's funny you use the word privilege. It was a kind of cultural privilege that I grew up in. We weren't mega wealthy or anything like that, but we did have this incredibly rich environment that my brother and sister and I grew up in. But you know, when you're a little kid, you don't have any frame of reference for what your life is like compared to anyone else's. And you don't know that your parents' friends are cultural luminaries. They're just your parents' friends. So it took a while for me to understand that my life or my environment was unusual. And that's one of the reasons that I called my book Famous Father Girl, because that's what my classmate Lisa used to call me in second grade, Famous Father Girl, to tease me. And so that was one of the early moments when I began to perceive that there was something different about me. And mainly it was because my father was on television and everybody watched television, you know? And so my father's young people's concerts were on CBS, often primetime television, several times a year. And in those days, as I love to tell today's young people, in those days, the entire family, all the generations, would sit down together in the living room in front of their single screen in their house and watch the young people's concerts together. So that's why everybody knew who Leonard Bernstein was, and it's why those young people's concerts had such a tremendous impact on more than one generation of viewers. Anyway, it took a while for me to realize that being Famous Father Girl meant that I had this larger-than-life luminary of a parent. And it took a while for that penny to drop.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying about everybody, you know, all generations watching the TV together. That was something, there were so many things in this book that really kind of allow you to reflect on how much the world has changed in a fairly short time, really in your lifetime. But for example, there are these stories of encounters with police and construction workers and people who knew your dad's work and loved him. And he got out of countless speeding tickets and things like that because the cops knew him because they'd watched him on television. It's hard to imagine a similar thing happening today.
Exactly. And I deliberately put in as many details as I could to show what the world was like then and to demonstrate how the world has changed. And one of those elements was the ubiquity of smoking cigarettes.
Yep.
And, you know, in my family, everybody smoked. My parents basically smoked in their every waking moment. And in my father's case, since he was such an insomniac, that meant basically all the time. In those days, every flat surface in every room had an ashtray on it. There were at least a half a dozen ashtrays in every room of our house. And at our dinner table, there were, you know, little individual ashtrays in front of everybody's plate. And everybody smoked between courses. In one passage, I write that I think they would have smoked while chewing if they could have.
Yep.
And this is something that was so much a part of our lives, and that really is gone now, for which I am grateful.
Right.
And in today's environment, you just don't encounter cigarette smoke in every public place you go to the way we used to. One of the main reasons that I dwelt on this in my book is that both my parents died of lung cancer. So it really is germane.
Yeah, and you know, I remember that time myself from my own childhood. And your dad, even like every piano had a cigarette burn mark, despite
right, the
all the ashtrays. But another big part of your life was your family life. I mean, your father was the son of immigrants, expected to go into the family business. His father was not happy, at least at first, with the idea of a son going into a musical career. But you had this really strong, interesting, loving, crazy extended family, as well as your two parents and two siblings. I would imagine that was somewhat grounding in the face of the whole celebrity thing as you were growing up.
It was extremely grounding. I really give a lot of credit, not just to my extended family, but also my mother, Felicia Montealegre. She was such an amazing person. And I mean, you would have to be amazing to be married to Leonard Bernstein. It was like marrying a tsunami, you know? He was so intense and so larger than life and dynamic and charismatic and exhausting, all of those things. And my mother really gave us this fantastically stabilizing, grounding environment to grow up in. And I think if we hadn't had her providing that for us, our lives might have turned out very different. But also my father's brother and sister, Burton and Shirley, were such amazing presences in our lives as we grew up. And having them around all the time was also very grounding. And also they loved to tease our dad and bring him down a peg. And so we grew up understanding that it was okay to do that.
Right.
And our dad kind of willingly submitted to it because he knew he was a little too much to handle and could be exhausting. So he was pretty good natured about the whole thing.
I mean, it's hard to be the child of, and you know, living in the shadows of someone who's considered a genius and a very charismatic and universally known genius. And I mean, there's this very kind of touching passage where you write about you're dancing and you're kind of making a circle around your father, and he's the sun and you're the satellite. And there was this kind of unspoken agreement that he was the only one in the family who really was allowed to be ambitious and obnoxious. Well, you were also, all three of you, very talented children. How did that family dynamic play out?
Well, this goes to the heart of what the book is about, is how we all navigated in our lives, you know, in the overwhelming glare of this bright sun that we lived under. Our dad was just so overwhelming in so many ways that it was a challenge for all three of us siblings to figure out who we were independent of that harsh sunlight. And it took a long time, and it wasn't always easy or pleasant. But that's really, you know, what the story is about, how we were able to do that eventually. And what helped a lot is that, you know, despite the overwhelmingness of it all, our family was so close-knit and the love was genuine. And that got us through a lot of the super tough passages. It did.
Your father asked you quite a number of times to collaborate with him, and you were always reluctant. Why was that? And do you regret it? Are you happy with your choices?
Well, I was very resistant to the idea because I already felt so overwhelmed, and then at one point in my life, I had made this questionable decision to pursue a career as a singer-songwriter myself. And it was so important to me to try and make the line very clear where my father ended and I began. And of course, by deciding to be a musician myself, I was making it triply hard on myself to establish where that line ran, where my father ended and I began. So I don't think I could have possibly made things more difficult for myself. And there was a part of me that loved being identified with my dad. I was proud of him and all the rest of it. But at the same time, I was trying so hard to establish myself as an individual. So let's just say I was confused about the whole thing. I was both proud and resistant. And it was all expressed through the music. And while I was trying to be a musician, I was very conflicted about performing. I was neurotic, really. In the book, I describe it as constantly having one foot on the gas and the other foot on the brake at the same time. And I was basically driving myself crazy. So it wasn't until I set aside making music with my own body. And then decades later, falling into this business of talking about music, that I realized I had inadvertently found a solution for this lifelong problem of one foot on the gas and the other foot on the brake. I found a way to keep myself in the world of music because I love music and I have a good ear. But making music with my own body just made me nuts. So I eventually realized, oh, I see. I've found a way to be in the world of music. I'm on the road, I'm surrounded by the musicians, and I have the musician's life, and I'm doing something useful, helping audiences enjoy the music more by talking about it with them and to them. And so in the book, I describe it as having cut off the ailing limb to allow the rest of the organism to thrive. And so I'm a kind of musical amputee, but I'm a pretty cheerful, high-functioning musical amputee, and I love what I do. I love talking and writing about music. It gives me a lot of pleasure, and I have absolutely no agita about doing it the way I did about making music with my own body.
There's a lot in the book about your father's artistic life, and one of the things I found so interesting is how he was a lot less interested in contemporary classical music, like the, atonal or 12-tone music that almost nobody really likes. And he was much more interested in the Beatles and rock music. And on the one hand, it felt so honest and it fostered so much creativity in him. But on the other side, it engendered a kind of dismissive attitude from the classical music establishment. Talk about that. I mean, did other people's opinions matter?
Yeah, I think my father cared possibly too much about what other people thought of him and his work, especially his compositions. He had this double life in a way. There was the side of him that was the conductor, very outgoing and very people connected and surrounded by people. And then the other side of him was the composer. And composers have to spend a lot of time alone. They're very solitary and they work all by themselves late at night. And he hated being alone, but he felt compelled to compose and he was hoping to be remembered as a composer primarily. So he had this kind of double existence. The problem with it was that it was so hard to be a composer. It was lonely and the gratification was so delayed and sometimes never came at all if he had spent, maybe a year or more working on a piece and then finally it comes out in the world and then gets bad reviews. That's very painful. Whereas, as a conductor, he was getting this basically instant gratification performing concerts with the great orchestras of the world in front of rapturous audiences who were just showering him with ovations. So I think that was a lifelong struggle for him, going back and forth between those two ongoing experiences.
As we were talking about before, there are so many things in this book that speak to the contrast between that era and our own era. And another one of them was that the adults were partying hard. They were having a wonderful time, and there was really nothing child-centered about it. It was really all about the adults. The kids were kind of along for the ride. Give us a sense of what that was like and what that was like for you kids.
Well, in the early years of our family, when it was just my brother and me, Alexander and I, and our sister Nina was born later on. So in those early years, Alexander and I shared a bedroom. And when we were going to sleep at night upstairs, we could hear the grown-ups carrying on downstairs, screaming with laughter over their charades and their word games, or roaring songs around the piano, our dad at the piano, of course, and everybody clustered around him. We could hear all that going on for hours. That was sort of our bedtime lullaby. So for a really long time, my brother and I thought that that's all grown-ups did, that all they did was have fun. We couldn't wait to be grown-ups. It was going to be a blast. And it wasn't until later on that we came to understand that being a grown-up was a little more complicated than we thought. In my memory, that realization came on a particular day, which was November 22nd, 1963, the day President Kennedy was assassinated. And on that day, the house was once again, as always, full of grown-ups, but they were all crying. And I don't really think I had ever seen a grown-up cry. So that was deeply shocking and dismaying. And I realized, whoa, I guess this being a grown-up thing is a little more complicated than I thought.
Another contrast that I was thinking about reading this was your relationship with one of your first boyfriends, a guy named Nick, who tried very hard to keep you down, basically. He keep you submissive and quiet, and that was very far from who you were, and he was verbally and even physically abusive. And in those days, so many young women, including you, really accepted that kind of treatment and tried to change to please the guy. How did that relationship affect you at the time and then in the years after?
Yeah, you know, I put those details into this book deliberately to make a distinction between how young people today approach their relationships and how much more aware we are of trying to keep the power dynamic more even between the genders. Whereas back in the 1960s, you know, we were still tethered to a much older version of how men and women were supposed to be around each other. You know, the women's movement had not kicked in its new incarnation that started up really in the late 60s, early 70s. By the time I was in college, the women's lib movement was really in high gear. But I was still kind of stuck in some older framework when I was in high school, which is when I had this relationship with the guy that I called Nick. It was very confusing for me, honestly, because, you know, we were all being encouraged in my all-girls school to express ourselves and to be capable humans in the world. And yet, somehow, with our boyfriends, it got more complicated. And this is why I put it in the book. I wanted young women today who read my book to really have a sense of what it was, what we were going through back in the 60s and 70s as we were trying to figure out how to be women in the world. And there was a part of me that was being told not to be, as the expression that Nick used was, loud and obnoxious. And oddly enough, that dovetailed with the message I was getting from my mother, which was, don't be loud and obnoxious the way your father is allowed to be because he's a genius, but you don't get to be that way. So it was a complicated thing to sort out. And I thought it was worth writing about because these are issues that women today deal with in quite a different way.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
One thing I was thinking about while I was reading your book was the fact that, I mean, your father was, I don't know if he considers himself gay or bisexual or whatever, but I mean, he was married with three children, but your mother knew before they married what his sexual orientation was, there was no acceptance of being openly gay at the time that your parents married. Had there been more acceptance, the three of you probably wouldn't have been born. Talk about the whole process of finding out that your father was gay, what that was like, and sort of how that played out for you and your siblings as kind of understanding your own place in the world.
Yeah, well, this is a, you know, a big thread in the book and something that I thought about a lot as I was writing. It was an amazing discovery to find that letter that our mother wrote to our father just around the time they got married, a little bit before or maybe just after, in which she says quite categorically, "You're a homosexual and I know it, but we adore each other and we want to have a life together, we want to have a family, and let's just plunge in and go forward into this grand experiment." It was an amazing letter to discover because we didn't know until we read that letter that she knew exactly what she was getting into and that both of them went into that marriage with their eyes wide open. And I would say that, you know, overall, the experiment was a giant success. They had us three kids and created this fantastic environment for us to grow up in, but eventually it really wasn't working for my mother at all. The last years of her life were very painful, not just psychologically, but physically too. You know, she had this terrible battle with cancer and eventually died of the disease. She was only 56. So there is a sense in which the troubles in the marriage contributed to the deterioration of her physical being. It's true that in the early 1970s, when my brother and sister and I were starting to figure out that our father had this sort of double life and that he was bisexual, there were very few words to talk about such things back then. And our family didn't know how to talk about it. And neither did the adults. We just didn't have the vocabulary yet. And similarly, when our mother was diagnosed with breast cancer and had to have a mastectomy, there was no vocabulary for that either. It was still a very shameful thing, and our mother was such a private person, and she really didn't want to talk about it. And so, you know, I think one of the impulses for me to write this book was to finally find the words.
It seems like your father found an awful lot of fulfillment in being a father and in having a wife, although it might not have been his first sexual preference. How do you understand that? I mean, now, thank God, there's been so much written and so much activism around sexuality, so that a lot of people might consider that life that he chose or was pushed into to be living a lie. But from your book, it seems more complicated than that.
It is more complicated than that. It's not so much that he was living a lie, because the truth of the matter was he was just himself in every context. So it wasn't like he was not being himself when he was with his family. That was a real authentic part of him that he expressed completely in his, you know, total embrace of his family. That, and so we never felt like he was not all there when he was with us. It's hard to explain. He just was multifaceted, but whatever facet he was expressing, it was all of him was in it, if you know what I mean. And yet, I guess it's true that his life in his family did not complete him as a human being, and he still had to express that other part of himself elsewhere, just as he could never express himself completely just as a conductor or just as a composer. He was so multifaceted.
I love the richness and detail in the descriptions of your life, especially that early part in the 1950s and 60s. And as you said, you know, you're talking about the ubiquity of cigarette smoking and so on. What was the process of remembering like? How did you put yourself back in that time to write this book?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, when it came to the really early years, I basically just had to go into what my sister calls the memory palace, where you just have to go inward and remember how things were. When it came to the later years, I was able to go back to my journals, and they were an incredible resource for me. Going back to those early journals was really a chore. I had to reread them all, and there were so many of them. And what they were mostly about was boyfriends, 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 boyfriends. And that's not really what I was looking for. I was looking for the little nuggets about my family life. And that stuff was in there, but I had to slog through the underbrush. It took a long time to slog through those journals.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing now.
So this thing that I am doing these days, talking about music in concerts, started around the year 2000 when I wrote this first kids concert about my dad called the Bernstein Beat. And it was very consciously modeled after my father's young people's concerts. And that sort of kicked off this thing that I do now a lot, which is to talk about music for all these different kinds of audiences, not just young people, but adult audiences, all kinds of audiences, and in all kinds of contexts. It inadvertently turned out to be the solution to this problem I had about being in the world of music. And if I just didn't make the music with my own body, I discovered I was much calmer, but still having a good time. So right now, I'm talking to you from Chicago, where tomorrow at the Ravinia Festival, I'll be premiering a brand new concert that is about my dad and has a narration and has the Chicago Symphony in it and has singers and young soloists and clips and it's got all this different stuff in it. So this is a kind of big one that has been in development for the last couple of years.
I find it so interesting that you really worked hard to be your own person and not to be in the shadow of your dad. But now, as you're a bit older, it kind of all comes around and it feels really right and integrated to me. And it's kind of a beautiful, in a way, resolution of what had been, when you were a young person, a struggle.
It's true, I mean, I tried so hard and struggled so much for so long to distance myself from my father and who he was in the world. And funnily enough, it all, I just relaxed about it finally, and it didn't matter anymore. Once I stopped trying to be a musician myself, I realized that I didn't care if people knew who my dad was. Instead of it being threatening, it became sort of an interesting thing to talk about. Leonard Bernstein was quite an amazing person in the world, and here I was, somebody who had grown up around him and had some very interesting details to add about him and who he was, and it wasn't threatening anymore. And also, I think because I spent so much time talking about all different musicians. My concerts are not just about my dad. They're about all kinds of musicians and topics in the world of music. And so after doing that for, nearly 2 decades, it helped me get over the whole allergy to my dad and his world. I realized that I had something to contribute to it myself, and it just wasn't a problem anymore. So that was kind of a relief.
The book is called Famous Father Girl, A Memoir of Growing Up Bernstein. Jamie Bernstein, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You are very welcome. This was really fun.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy, supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers. Visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.